So I'm giving one of these talks that we have scheduled one a day at most. And I guess we have to see how it works out. So the idea is, of course, to have it a loose discussion, kind of interactive talk. And I put a lot of stuff in there, so I have to see how far I get. I think we're not being cut off by anybody, but of course you want to go to bed at some point, I suppose. No, I aim for 45 minutes or so. So I gave it a title, Active Storing of Cells, because we're talking about active materials, active matter, in this whole workshop. And many of the people who are working on active matter in the bio fields, of course, are thinking about cells. And so we have been doing experiments on cells, also in vitro experiments. So I start with in vitro sort of non-cellular experiments first. And maybe the sort of tutorial part of the story, for those of you who are not so familiar with that, is going to be in the beginning, where we'll introduce this whole idea of doing microrheological measurements that some of you, of course, are very familiar with, but maybe others not. So we can go into depth, of course, anywhere, but we can also talk about that later. I mean, there's many sort of tangents one can go off on, and all sorts of technical issues that one could discuss that might lead too far now or take too much time if we do it now. But let's see. And if you have questions, please feel free to interrupt. So cells are, of course, sort of the hydrogen atoms of biology, but they are by far more complicated than hydrogen atoms. And they're also our favorite object for looking at active matter, or our favorite example of active matter, because they obviously do a lot of non-equilibrium activities. And if you look at them, you see lots of interesting dynamics. Now, here's a layer of cells in the culture dish. This is actually a video I downloaded from Michael Davidson's fantastic microscopy resource website at the University of Florida. And you see a number of these epithelial cells sitting on this culture dish, and some of them are, these two actually are in the process of doing mitosis, they're dividing. So you see that there's lots of very sort of organized activity going on in mitosis. Of course, the cells have to follow a very well-prescribed procedure to not make any mistakes and to do this properly. And we talked yesterday about one of the topics in active matter, or in the context of biology at least, is error correction. So this mitosis is a good example of an active process where it's very important to do everything right. And nature of cells spend a lot of metabolic energy to make sure that everything is being done right. If you look at the other cells that are not dividing when the movie is running, you see there's also lots of activity. This is time lapse, of course, but you see these microtubules that are labeled here are moving all over the place. And in red, of course, is DNA, and here it's condensed to chromosomes. Or histones actually here are labeled. So this is kind of the active material of our choice, at least. But when we want to talk about or do something quantitative with active materials, we need to be clear about a few properties and a few issues. And one very important property of all these materials are their mechanical viscoelastic properties. Because if we want to say something or learn something about the forces acting, we need to know both. We need to know the forces that are acting, and we need to know the response of the material in order to be able to say something from the fluctuations and the movements we observe about one or the other. So we need several experiments to kind of characterize materials. And just to get everybody on the same wavelength, typically one can measure shear elastic moduli in these watery solutions of polymers, very vaguely speaking. Now the cell, of course, is consisting of lots of proteins, protein polymers, membranes, and so forth. But all of that is immersed in water, so it's a watery solution, and the water is incompressible. So the only, for all practical purposes, the only important deformations are shear deformations. And the interior of a cell being viscoelastic due to all these protein polymers means we will get partially elastic and partially viscous response. It's something we talked about yesterday as well. This will depend on time scales. So if you look at a cell in a certain sort of low frequency video type window, you see mostly elastic properties. If you look at tissue at very long time scales, you see kind of flowing behavior or viscous behavior again. And if you look at higher frequencies, say above 100 hertz or so, you see again viscoelastic behavior, so coupled viscous and elastic response. And of course, the shear elastic modulus connects the strain and the stress. And this being a viscoelastic material means we can describe that with a complex shear elastic modulus, with a real part describing the elastic part and the imaginary part describing the viscous, or being the loss modulus describing the viscous response. That is typically done, of course, in chemical engineering or material science with macroscopic instruments like plate and cone rheometers. But if you want to look at cells, we need to make these experiments on a small scale. So we need to do what we and others have been calling microrheology. And now one way we do this is by putting small colloids of micron size, so 1 micron, 2 micron diameter beads, or sometimes less and sometimes a bit more, into a polymer solution that we want to study. And in this sort of sample video, you see the modes we can apply. So we can look at fluctuations in the first part of the movie, not this part, but the other part. You see just thermal fluctuations. So it's a Brownian motion in this viscoelastic background, which is actin in this case. So you don't see the actin, it's not labeled in any way, but it's there. And so here now you see the thermal fluctuations. And then at some point, we turn on this optical device, this optical trap, and pull on the bead, and pull it away from its equilibrium position, and then let it snap back. So we can use this active mode as well and do what we call active microrheology. So looking at the thermal fluctuations is what we call passive microrheology, and pulling this object, this probe, out of its equilibrium position and wiggling it is what we call active microrheology. Now, going to the non-equilibrium or active systems right away, this is sort of a sketch of what we have been doing in vitro in reconstituted systems a while ago. We take these beads again like that, micron-sized colloids, embed them in the gel without attaching them to anything in particular. So they're just kind of caught in the network where the mesh size is kind of not drawn to scale here. So the mesh size in these typical cytoskeletal actin networks is something on the order of 100 nanometers, so maybe 50 to 100 nanometers. And these beads are microns. So the mesh is much smaller than the bead, and the bead is stuck in the network. And it's just fluctuating along with the network. But then to make this active and make it more similar to a real cytoskeleton, one can introduce motors. And this is supposed to be a sketch of a polymeric myosin aggregate. Myosin is the motor that makes muscles contract, but it's also in charge of most of the cellular dynamics that you will see and in a way already have seen in the first movie. We get back to that. But actin and myosin are the big players for all these cell locomotion type dynamics and fluctuations in cells. Mitosis is a different story. So in mitosis, it's kinesin motors that are pushing the microtubules apart. Okay, so there's three large families of motors: dyneins, kinesins, and myosins. And the myosins are mostly in charge of the cytoskeletal sort of random, sometimes directed motility. So in an in vitro system, of course, there's no order in the actin. We have a sort of isotropic network of actin, and here is the system again in the video. So you see all these these beads here as little inclusions. So it's just looking at one plane, sort of away from the cover slip, in the middle of a, say, 100 micron thick sample. And all this motion that you see here is actually, like, most 99% of that is driven by the activity of the motors. I have the control, I can show you later. If we don't give the motors ATP, if you don't give them fuel, then everything is totally stuck. By eye, you basically don't see any motion in this high density and high crosslink density of this network. So this is a nice model system for an active system. It's more or less stationary because we keep the ATP concentration at least for a couple of hours or so in a range where the motors are running. Actually, well, it slowly runs down, but you can also recreate the ATP. So there's some tricks. But we keep it more or less stationary, but out of equilibrium. And we prevent the network from collapsing. That's another trick here. If you let the motors run free without cross-linking the network strongly, then the network will just collapse. And it's called superprecipitation, or you get all these sort of interesting aggregation dynamics and so forth. That's a different story, more complicated, but this is a simple case. We keep it more or less isotropic, and we also, in that way, isolate the different force generation centers from each other. Now, the motors, of course, don't exert, the beads don't exert any force. It's the motors that are sitting in between these little force dipoles, And if the network itself is strongly cross-linked, then they don't talk much to each other. They talk a little bit to each other, but they'll clump up and bundle up. Okay, so now applying this microrheology technology to this kind of system, we can do a trick. We can use a combination of this passive method and the active method to extract the non-equilibrium part of the fluctuations from the recorded data. And it's a bit of a lengthy story, but so I just want to sketch it briefly. If there's questions, we can also talk about that later. But we record the position of these probe beats. Now, I showed you this whole video frame full of beats. In the high bandwidth measurements, we just pick one of the beats, train our optical trap or optical or laser beam on that, and then use that laser light to do high frequency or high bandwidth recording of the position. So we get time series data of the position of one of these probe beats. We just do a Fourier transform and calculate a power spectral density from that. And then we use fluctuation dissipation to extract the imaginary part of the response function. Now that holds in equilibrium. Okay, so let's assume for a moment we are in equilibrium. So once we have that, we can use Cramer's Kronig integral to get the real part. That's also a tricky story by itself. You need a lot of bandwidth in order to make the edge effects go away in the middle. But you can do it, and you get the real part. And once you have the real and the imaginary part, you can calculate the G, which is just the inverse of the response function, with a geometrical parameter. So the beat size goes in here as well. Depends. The fluctuations, of course, depend on the size of that probe particle. So that gives, in the end, gives us G prime, G double prime in the case of equilibrium. Okay, now, if the system is not in equilibrium, then this will not be right, because the fluctuations will be the fluctuations will be larger than what you would expect from a given response function. Right? The material has a response function, but the fluctuations, if they're driven by motors, will be larger. So this side of the equation will be larger than the right-hand side. But that's the trick we can actually use to isolate the non-equilibrium part, because we can combine in the same experiment with the same laser, microscope, everything, we can combine active microrheology by just moving that optical trap. You know, we have this laser beam trained on that particle. We just wiggle it around, like symbolized here. And we then measure the amount, the amplitude of the motion of that particle when it's following or trying to follow that optical trap. So we exert a periodic force on that particle and measure how much it moves. And that's a direct measurement, of course, when we have this fluctuating force, we measure the displacement. It's a direct measurement of the response function. And that's only measuring the mechanics. There's no fluctuation, no active, passive, whatever, non-equilibrium involved. We're just measuring the mechanical response. And then, of course, we can go back and compare the response function that we measure here with the fluctuations that we observe. And if there's a discrepancy, then we know the system is not in equilibrium. So having this combination of two techniques in the same experiment allows us to check this fluctuation dissipation theorem. And if it's violated, there must be non-equilibrium. Right, so that's sort of the idea. You can formalize that and write it down. So the total fluctuations are the sum of non-equilibrium and thermal. This is what you want to have. You get the thermal fluctuations that you don't directly see, but you can calculate them from the measured response function that you get from this active method. It's a bit confusing talking about active methods and active microrheology and active systems. So sorry, I'm using the word active in two contexts. So confuses even me. From this wiggling method, if you want to call it like that, we get this the real response function that gives us the power spectral density of the thermal fluctuations that would be there if there was no activity in the system, no non-equilibrium. And that means if you just subtract the measured fluctuations or subtract the thermal part from the measured fluctuations, what's left is a non-equilibrium part.
This,
okay. Well, alpha double prime. It's the response function, right? So we need to do one over.
One more to using the second relationship. You got G double prime.
You first need to get alpha prime because you need to calculate one divided by alpha star, the complex alpha, and for that you need both real part and an imaginary part.
And so from that you get the real part.
Here we get the real part with edge effects. So experimentally you have to worry about the cutoff effects, but they go for about a decade into the data. So you still have a bunch of data that's good. And then in that range, you can actually, I should have written it the other way around. So G is the final result, and we get it by dividing 1 divided by alpha with these factors. Right, and we have the two parts of alpha from here, from the measurement and from the Kramers-Kronig integral.
My eyes are bad. That's
G star. Oh, I'm sorry, yeah, maybe I should have made it larger.
Are you using other methods to do it in the crystals? Because there are some ways where you don't lose that extra decade.
Well, I mean, you can do it with the Laplace transform method, but then you need to make assumptions in a way about how it's continuing as well, or about the functional form. So it's kind of hard to get around that problem if you only observe fluctuations. If you do the active measurement, you don't have that problem. You don't lose anything.
Right.
You know, then if you wiggle the bead, then you get the real part and imaginary part from the same measurement, and both is measured, and everything's fine.
Right. Just as Mike Evans had this nice method for doing that, I mean, Mike may work on that as well, which is a different one.
Yeah, yeah. There was also this paper by Dan Frankel recently, right?
Okay.
Which I have to still fully digest. So he also says that it could work.
So just technically, I think there's also
better
alternatives, right?
Yeah. So there's lots of little details I don't mention right now. Okay, so we have this way of pulling out the non-equilibrium part. And if you do that with the data I showed you from this video with all the moving beads in this actin-myosin network, if the system is dead, so if there's no myosin or no ATP around, then the fluctuation experiment and the wiggle experiment give the same result. You know, this is just this response, the imaginary part of the response function that comes either from the wiggle experiment, which are the dots, or from the fluctuation observation, which are the drawn lines and the dotted lines. So they agree as they should, because fluctuation dissipation should hold. Right? Now, if we activate the motors and they're pulling, they're doing their wiggling, then we see some stuff happens out here. So the curve is not exactly the same, but at least the two measurements agree out here at frequencies above 100 hertz. But below that frequency, there's a large discrepancy on this log scale. So the factor of 10 difference in the fluctuations that the system exhibits to what the thermal fluctuations should be, you know, given the active measurement we have done. So this is clearly in the non-equilibrium. Basically, the difference between the two is the non-equilibrium part of the fluctuations. Now, this, if you think about it, this also, in a way, does away with any effective temperature modeling. Because people, especially in colloids, have been trying to describe non-equilibrium in active matter by an effective temperature. But here you see, for every frequency, of course, you could define an effective temperature if you want. But it doesn't really make much sense if you have to define a frequency-dependent effective temperature, because that's sort of the whole idea of the effective temperature being a universal, like one number, goes away. So it doesn't seem to be reasonable to describe this kind of non-equilibrium dynamics by something like effective temperature. Okay, so then of course you have to look at where it really comes from. What is going on here? But let's get to cells, and while I show you some data from cells, I get back to that. Now, cells of course have their own will, and they do all sorts of funny stuff. So, in one sense, it's easier to work with a cell than with a whole organism, of course, or tissue. It's easy to make round cells as opposed to cows, which are not so easy to get round. But cells, you just trypsinize, and then they become round because they have surface tension and osmotic pressure. So that's nice. The geometry is simple. But then they do stuff like this. So they divide sometimes. now, this is by itself interesting. We haven't really evaluated much of that. But this is a suspended cell where we have 4-micron beads now attached via fibronectin to opposing sides of that cell, away from suspended away from the surface. And we are measuring with our optical traps, with a dual set of optical traps, now the forces being exerted here. And there's lots of interesting stuff going on. But this is just one lucky video that Florian, the student who did that, got. So we haven't really done much more with this dividing cell. But we're looking at non-dividing cells and studying the fluctuations. But again, these cells, even if they're not dividing, can be extremely active. So here, you see, I think, a movie of about, a minute or so. Or no, it must be a bit more, must be like a few minutes, where the cell is like trying to gobble up this bead here, and it's doing all sorts of strange stuff. Some blebbing here, and then, of course, there's some other beads falling into the trap. So that kills the experiment anyway. But you know, cells are quite individual, and every cell is different from every other cell, and you have to worry about the cells dying or being healthy enough, and so forth. So it's kind of tricky to extract some universal behavior from cell experiments. But you can try. So we did a whole bunch of experiments just looking at the force fluctuations between these two beads. They're suspended, so all the forces, of course, have to be balanced between these two sides, right? So that is also clearly seen here, that the forces are anti-correlated, except for some thermal noise that's in the small wiggle here. But the slow timescale variations of force are clearly anti-correlated, because there's no other source of force on this cell. And being anti-correlated, of course, means this is active. You know, there's no other way to get anti-correlated forces than having forces exerted by the cell, force dipoles more or less pulling or pushing on these two beads. If you take a vesicle in the same geometry, you just see Brownian noise, so just that system. You do the same type of analysis now with the two types of experiments, the wiggle experiment and the fluctuation experiment. You again see this discrepancy. Now, this is plotted slightly differently on a linear scale, because you get negative correlations between the two beads because of these forces. But again, you see the wiggle experiment gives you almost zero viscous response and almost completely elastic response. This is the real part, the imaginary part. And you see the active non-equilibrium fluctuations in this deviation here that violates the fluctuation dissipation theorem. Now, I said we should now kind of zoom into this range and see what's going on there, so if we can explain this, maybe something universal happening here. And it turns out that all the cells we have looked at, and also the data we got from the in vitro system, give this very peculiar scaling in the power spectral density. Now, this is the force fluctuation power spectral density. Right, so I get back to that so that you see what that means. But it has this very obvious, close to 1 over omega squared scaling. And this is something many people have seen in other contexts, in cells and on cells and so forth. So that seems to be quite a universal dynamic feature of these actin myosin generated motions, random sort of random motions in cells. I have more data on different types of cells, and then we have done many cells, so we always get this 1 over omega squared behavior. Now, where does that come from, or what could it be? One model that seems to be the simplest right now, and to me at least the most convincing, is very simple, actually. It's based on the fact that these motors exert force, but they have a force correlation time. So they build up tension for a certain time, and on sort of scale of seconds or tens of seconds, they let go. So in this case, you have myosin clusters, so aggregates of on the order of 20 or so myosins. So that means that they can hold on, they can exert force over extended times. And of course, at some point, the force is getting too large, or somebody else is pulling somewhere else, and then you have typically catastrophic release events. So the buildup of tension is slow, and the release of tension, of stress, tends to be fast. You see that here in one example of the motion between two beads in this in vitro experiment. So you see a relatively slow buildup and the fast release. But I mean, this may be hard to measure in the superimposed activity of many of these force dipoles. But if you think about what that means, it's a very easy way to, a very straightforward way to explain this 1 over omega squared behavior. And this is something that Alex Levine and Fred McIntosh worked out in this paper a couple of years ago. The observed displacement fluctuations that we, of course, see with the beads have to be the force fluctuations divided by the modulus of the material. Right, so that's of course just the definition of the response, and this is what we are trying to explain. This is what we measure. Now, if the force has this idealized behavior, that it's on for a time that's longer than the observation time, you say this is 0.1 hertz, so longer than 10 seconds, and then suddenly comes off, then of course the power spectral density of that is just the Fourier transform of a step function squared. And that's 1 over omega, and the square gives you 1 over omega squared. So it's a very simple way to, very simple model to explain the 1 over omega squared displacement power spectral density if the force spectrum looks like, or the forces look like that in time, and the G is actually a flat line. Now this is purely elastic behavior, and this is what you expect from cells at low frequencies. They look like an elastic piece of rubber at these frequencies between, or say 0.01 hertz or 10th or 100th of a hertz to about 10 hertz or so. They're more or less rigid elastic objects. And in that case, this type of force time behavior gives you exactly this omega minus 2 scaling. So that's the part I wanted to talk about in the beginning. And then I get more into the what I wrote in the title, the stirring dynamics and so forth. So just to conclude on this first part, this combination of the two microrheology methods is a good way to study non-equilibrium and to isolate the non-equilibrium part. We talked about that yesterday a little bit, like what, how can you tell if a system is out of equilibrium? If you have the liberty to do these experiments, these combined experiments, and test fluctuation dissipation, then it's fairly straightforward. But of course, one has to keep in mind, you can't always do that. If you have video recordings and you don't have a way to actively get in there, or if you have two different experiments, an active one and a totally different observation of other variables, when you look at fluctuations, it sometimes gets very hard to compare. So in this idealized experiments, it's fairly straightforward, also with the cells, but it gets, for example, already much more complicated inside cells. Now, this one of this maybe universal dynamics we and others have seen is this one of our omega squared spectrum that may well be due to this particular force behavior, that forces build up slowly and then suddenly release. Stress fluctuations have this particular behavior. I should say, I'll get back to that later, but if you get to even lower frequencies or longer times, then of course they become, the force fluctuations should look like delta functions eventually, and then the spectrum should flatten out, should turn over. Myosin is clearly responsible for these fluctuations in the suspended cells, because I didn't show you the results, but if you add a drug that turns off the myosin, there's one drug called blebbistatin, then the amplitude goes way down, and if you add enough, it just disappears. So these fluctuations, these omega, one of omega squared fluctuations, clearly come from myosin. If you knock out the microtubules, there's other drugs you can use to knock out microtubules, cortisol, for example. Nothing much happens, so microtubules don't have much to say, not much to do. And I didn't really get into that, but we are still trying to kind of make the cells respond to the forces we exert. Of course, in the end, it's going to be interesting to see how an active material responds to external input of some kind, maybe mechanical input. Chemical input is clear, but mechanical input would be nice. And cells are expected to do something when you pull on them. But unfortunately, the forces that we use are only, the optical traps are only a few piconewtons, 100 piconewtons or so, and the cells don't care at all. They just do whatever they want to do, and they don't seem to be perturbed very much by the presence of the forces. The beads, of course, they react to the beads and they try to eat them up, but if we pull or not pull, it doesn't really change anything. So that's work in progress. So this was done by, actually the whole active microrheology business and the first experiments were done, started by Daisuke Mizuno, who was a postdoc in Amsterdam still, and then also worked in Göttingen intermittently. He's now at Kyushu University as a professor. And Florian Schlosser is doing the experiments now with the cells. And Florian Rehfeld is a junior group leader in my group who's kind of in charge of many of the cell experiments. And this has been a long-time collaboration with Fred McIntosh, and back in Amsterdam, Catherine Tardin was another postdoc who worked on the in vitro experiments together with Daisuke. So now let me get into the cells more. We looked at in vitro, we looked at outside the cell, so taking the whole cell as a spherical cell and not worrying about the inside. But now I want to show you some experiment where we get into the inside of the cell. And in order to do that, I have to make a little technical detour and talk about the probes that we have been using.
Before you go on, can I ask a question?
Sure.
How does G omega depend on the concentration of the myosin?
I didn't point that out. There's an effect, of course. The more motor activity you have, the more stress you have in the network. Also, DC stress. And that gives you a nonlinear response, as you know, in the network. So we see in the in vitro experiments a clear stiffening of the network by two orders of magnitude. You probably remember the data, right? When the myosin is turned on. So the pretension tends to stiffen the network. Now this is much harder to show in the cells because I can show you the spread of the data. Problem is with the cells, they're all over the place. So from cell to cell, the orders of magnitude different in the absolute amplitude of the fluctuations. And that also depends, of course, on the attachment of the bead to the cell. If you have it's more complicated. I mean, initially, I thought if you have a large attachment, you should get a stiffer response. And if you have a small bead or a small attachment, you get softer response. We tried different bead sizes between, I think, 0.5 microns and 8 microns, and there was almost no difference. So a bulk Hertz-type model is not the right model. So one has to make a shell-type model, right? Because then the thickness of the shell is important, but not so much the attachment area.
And also the departure of the fluctuation spectrum from FDT, does that become more and more as you have more motors?
In Daisuke's experiments, he didn't really go very far in terms of testing different motor concentrations because it wasn't so easy to get the motors to work in the first place. It's a tricky story with myosins. You have to be at the right salt concentration to get aggregates that are processed that are large enough to be able to exert force. And then you have to have the right ATP concentration to do that. So you can vary all these parameters, but you very quickly end up in a system where nothing moves anymore. It locks into Rigor. Or the ATP runs out too fast or so. So we haven't systematically varied the myosin concentration.
There are also data on softening, larger myosin concentration.
Yeah. From Josef Case, you mean the...
Maybe you know the models or so.
Yeah, there's of course, again, a time scale issue. If you have, if you look at the motion of a cell or the whole gel, of course, it may soften in the sense that motors can relax the constraints if actins get moved around. But in our case, we actually cross-linked the hell out of these things. But we used myotin strapped avidin to really strongly cross-link the gel, right? And so there's no soft. The motors don't change much, relatively speaking, in the cross-link density. So it's always rigid. So they can't soften much. If you have a non-cross-link gel, then you get, of course, more dynamics. So you release constraints, which is a softening effect. But you also create concentration fluctuations. So you get clumps of actin myosin. So
what is problematic here is that all these characteristics, they assume that you have a homogeneous medium. And the theory actually works with the actin network, apparently, the fluid phase is not so important. But
right.
If you are talking about actin network, it is even compressive.
I mean, the situation in the cells, for example, in a locomoting cell, in a fish keratocyte or so that's moving on the ground, is probably different because the actin is reconfigured very quickly on a timescale of minutes. So then you have an effective flow or an effective fluid behavior, and then models that model the network as a fluid may be more appropriate. So it's a matter of timescales again and kind of constraint release. And if you have constraint release coupled with motor activity, then of course you can fluidize the system in a way. So that's probably the way one should discuss that. You know that in the limit of a solidly cross-linked network, it's rigid and stiff all the time. You just get fluctuations or no fluctuations. But if you allow the filaments to move around, then the added moving coming from the motors will of course change the relaxation of the network. Is that what you were aiming at, right? Or?
I think maybe I'm not putting words in your mouth, but I think Professor Pesman was not talking about treadmilling. He's talking about the fluid phase. Are you flowing in ATP as the experiment goes through? Or it's the fluid phase is not actually...
Oh, you mean the coupling between the water and the network? Maybe I missed that, sorry.
Yes, well, what I meant, this is actually a two-phase medium.
Yeah.
This two phases, they happen in a very different way. And you're right that sometimes the formation of the solid dominates and sometimes probably movement of the liquid. but here, when you describe it by single modules, you don't distinguish between
these. That's right.
And this is why this may work better in one case and worse in another.
Yeah, it's definitely that's true. It's been a point of lots of discussion how much compressibility you can see in these networks, in these water. I mean, they're very low volume fraction networks. They have, 1% to 10% volume fraction of polymer in water solution. So they're quite dilute.
Yes,
and you would expect it to
concentrate and make it concentrate very easily.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you don't have motors above frequencies of about 1 to 10 hertz, it doesn't seem to happen. We've never measured. We couldn't never measure any sign of compressibility. And the rationale for that has always been that the coupling between the network and the fluid becomes quite strong. So it's much more costly to compress the gel than to shear it. So whatever kind of deformation you impose to the beads. The network reacts by shearing in a much softer, it's a softer spring, if you want, and the compressional deformation is basically stopped by the water incompressibility because the coupling between network and water is too strong. If you go to very low frequencies, it should at some point compress, but we have never managed to see that because the data get very noisy at say, below 0.1 hertz, 0.01 hertz.
Well, in the vitro, you see it very clearly in the Kanderling's experiments. They just collapse.
That's
without binding.
If you add motors, of course, then you get around that. So if you add motors, the motors act like a compressional agent, but then they also make the whole system inhomogeneous. So then it's kind of hard. You can't describe it with one modulus anymore at all.
If I might add to this, first off, you're saying the theory by Fred and Alex, that actually it is a two-fluid model. So it is a coupled fluid elastic system with motors thrown in, and it is an incompressible system. But it does have both elasticity and fluids built in that model.
So I mean, the whole two-particle microrheology and Lebensky and so on, Levine-Lebensky.
Levine-Lebensky paper didn't have the activity, but the McIntosh Levine paper has activity, and it's a two-component model in the sense of an elastic network permeating fluids.
Yeah. But I mean, people who had done the two-fluid model before, there's the Levine-Lubensky stories, have sort of mapped it out theoretically. But this additional compression force, if you want, from motors is a different story. Yeah. So that.
But also, Alex is going to be here, I think, later this month for a different workshop.
Yeah.
Get him to.
Fred is also going to be here later. It's certainly an interesting ongoing discussion. But of course, once the network becomes inhomogeneous, this whole G double prime business is kind of useless, I guess, at some point. So one has to come up with different ways of describing it. So let's go back to this technical aspect. So we have been starting to use these single-walled carbon nanotubes, which are related to buckyballs and graphenes and all that, as probes. And the idea is we can make them fluorescent, or we have ones that are fluorescent in the near infrared, so we can follow them, track them very well in cells or even in whole organisms. And they're kind of stealth probes because they have a diameter of only a nanometer, and they can have lengths of up to 20 microns or so. So they have these extreme aspect ratios, and we can kind of smuggle them into any old system we want in the cell, in the nucleus, everywhere, and use the imaging of those guys to study fluctuations. And so here you just see diffusion in water. So they're semi-flexible. You can see some on the micron scale, some bending modes here. But they're, of course, much stiffer than typical technical polymers. They're actually comparable to actin in terms of persistence length. And they're a single sheet of carbon atoms, so two-dimensional carbon systems. And they have this excitonic kind of, at least the semiconducting ones have this excitonic mechanism of fluorescence. And that is interesting because the band gap is, the Stokes shift is very large. So they have excitation wavelengths in the visible, in the green, sort of up to the near infrared. But the emission wavelengths are in the near infrared up to 1300 or so nanometers. So there's a very large Stokes shift. It's very easy to isolate the fluorescence light from the excitation light. And it's in a wavelength range where there's no background in cells or in tissues. So it's an ideal probe for tracking. And they don't bleach. So this is an inorganic type of of fluorescence, there's and then you know, the molecules are very stable, obviously, with the carbon this carbon structure. So there's no blinking or bleaching or any of this stuff that usually haunts people who do fluorescence. So what we do for measuring dynamics and transport in cells, we wrap them in single-stranded DNA. You have to make them water-soluble, so it's all these technical details. But DNA is good for that single-stranded DNA, and we can modify the DNA to bind to specifically target whatever you want to target. So we use what's called a halo tag, in this case, to bind these fluorescent tags to motor proteins that we transfect the cells with, which have the counterpart of that halo tag. And that forms a covalent bond by taking out this chloride here, and is a very specific and very strong way of tagging, specifically tagging objects in cells or proteins in cells. So this, you know, the whole story in the end is that this protein that we have, that we attach to the end of a motor protein, express it attached to the end of the motor protein, binds covalently to the tube, and then of course we can see by fluorescence where this motor is going. Now I'm talking about motors, so we have to come back to the networks. But it's actually a bit of a detour. The long ones, the long nanotubes, you can use for other types of microrheology. You can look at the bending fluctuations and analyze them. This is just in water, so you can look at the spectrum, and you know, has a 1 over q to the power 4 spectrum, amplitude dependency, and so forth. You can look at them during reptation. So here, this is an experiment that my postdoc, Nikta Fakhri, who did this work, she did that for a PhD thesis. So she looked at reptation of semi-flexible filaments in dense gels. And you can do it in actin filaments. So here you see a very long one, in an actin network, and in vitro actin network again. And you can look at the fluctuations. And now we're working on making this non-equilibrium and sort of, I can come back to that later maybe if I have time. But in this experiment I want to show you now, we just used very short ones and attached them to motors in cells. Now this is fluorescence microscopy of a whole cell. The cell is about this size. The nucleus was somewhere here. And you only see the fluorescence from these nanotubes. And if you look closely, this is a long time recording. So it goes about 10 minutes or so. It's sped up about eightfold. And what we label here are so-called kinesin-1 motors. So these are the transport motors that bring vesicles from one part of the cell, from the Golgi typically to the edge of the cell. And if you look, see, there's one that's making a very long journey, starting over here, and this guy here. It's going over here, and now it's hanging here for a while, and then it's going all the way down here. And so you can follow these single motors over many microns and over times of minutes and even hours, because these fluorescent dyes don't bleach. And so that's an interesting way to study transport in cells. Now, the motors, of course, primarily do directed transport. And that's something I don't want to really talk about here. It's also ongoing work. But it's a nice way, it's actually a unique way to look at transport in cells, because most people only have succeeded in looking at very short times in intracellular single molecule fluorescence. But with these guys, you can look like for hours. But sure. One or two this time.
One.
If it does, it divides.
In this case, you showed the polymer oscillating or fluctuating.
Yeah.
Has that been analyzed a lot? Has that worked? Is there a typical frequency it's peaked at, or is it just a random spectrum?
Yeah, it's another talk in a way. It's a pretty long story. We can talk about it later. When we have. Especially, we're just doing it now. We're analyzing these fluctuations in actin to measure the viscoelasticity of actin in this kind of stealth way, right? Because we don't have a bead here, so we're not disturbing the actin by having a huge bead in there. And we still have that length scale. We still have the 20 microns, so we can probe the rheology on these length scales from a fraction of a micron to 10 microns without having a big bead in there. But it's a different story. But
so here it is just not all. Elastic rod inside a fluid, which is being.
This is a fluid case, so that's very very simple. Right? You have the kappa, the bending stiffness of that. Let's see. You need the bending stiffness of this thing, and then you need the viscosity, and you can model the fluctuations.
You get
the viscosity of the medium. Very straightforward. Here, Nikta has done reptation and looked at the effect of semi-flexibility on the reptation dynamics, the effect of rotational diffusion, and so on. This is ODIKE versus DOI models and so forth. And This is another whole story. And then here we're trying to use them to test, to measure both passive properties of, say, an actin gel, but also in the end, active fluctuations in cells or also in the nucleus. So it is not trivial. There's lots of tricks here. It's doing reptation. When you look at it, at first we thought we can just look at the fluctuations, but the thing is it's reptating while it's fluctuating. So you have to kind of either fix it somewhere or you have to somehow isolate it, like take out the reptation dynamics, and that's not so easy. And it turns out if you look at modes here, most people have done cosine modes, like Fourier modes. They're not the norm, the dynamic normal mode. So you have to do a more fancy mode analysis and so on. So it's coming, slowly coming together, but we haven't totally figured it out yet. But actually, I wanted to talk about this other case where we use the little ones. So these are very short fragments, and we use the motors, and we use the motors now to track fluctuations. That's the basic idea. So
is it the helotag so that you're only getting the kinesin 1? Is that right?
Yeah, the only molecule in the cell that has a helotag is by transfection is the SCIF5C. We have done the controls where we don't have anything labeled, and then they just sit around. They don't do much. So they're not being passively transported. They're really sitting on a motor. But that motor, of course, is sitting with a bunch of colleagues on a vesicle, I'm pretty sure. So it's not a motor by itself, but it's a motor doing its transport business, probably together with a couple other motors and dynines and so forth. But yeah, we're still busy analyzing that. But I want to focus on slightly different angle. I mean, this is an example. So here's this one trace maximum intensity projection, where you see actually all the long traces. And you can look at velocities and intermittency and speeds and all that stuff. You can follow the, in our setup right now, we can follow it only in two dimensions. But in principle, of course, you can also follow it in three dimensions if you have feedback on the microscope, which we haven't done yet. But I don't want to talk more about this directed transport. I want to get to the random fluctuations. And that's something that has been underappreciated. Most people have done motor experiments in vitro on tracks that are laid down on the ground. Now you take a microtubule, you stick it to a glass surface, and then you put your myosin, or your kinesin motor on top, on a bead or just by itself, and you let it run. And then you see just the motor activity. But in the cell, the tracks are mobile. And so this is, again, a movie from Michael Davidson's website. You see here a spread cell, an adherent cell. And you see, again, with some time lapse, you see that the whole network of tracks, the whole network of the whole highway system is kind of fluctuating. Right? And so now you can, of course, use these motors for dual purposes. You can study the transport of the motors along the tracks, but you can also study the dynamics of the tracks using the motors, because you know the motors are on the tracks when they're moving, so you know what you're looking at, which is an advantage to putting beads somewhere in the cell, because you don't know what they're stuck to. And here you have a stealth probe again. It's a small molecular probe that's not in this, in the next one. But in our case, where we can just follow these fluctuations. And we can follow them with fairly high resolution, much better resolution than you can get out of these labeled microtubules. Now, one thing to realize, and I'll show you the proof of that, is that the dynamics of these tracks are driven by myosin. Now, we're talking about kinesin running on microtubules, but the motions of the microtubules are driven by the myosins that are pulling on the actin that the microtubules are embedded in. This is a bit of a leap of logic here. But and I'll show you how we can prove that. But the microtubules are threading through this actin network, which has, after all, a mesh size of something like 100 nanometers. And they're kind of stuck in there, and they're moving around, being moved around actively by the myosins pulling on the actin. And we can isolate that motion even on a motor that's moving along the microtubule by the fact that the microtubule is fairly straight. So we can just analyze the motion along so we can low pass filter basically the shape of the track. And we can analyze the off-axis and the on-axis, so the axial motion and the off-axis motion. And this axial motion is the driven motion by the kinesin, more or less. And this off-axis motion is the fluctuation of the track. Right? So that's a trick to get the track fluctuations out of the data. And so when we do that, actually at first we also did it. I didn't point that out, but many of these fluorescent dots are stationary for a while. And sometimes they start moving. So this is an example where, with a fairly low frame rate, It was stuck for a while, and stuck in a sense, not totally immobile, but was moving on a spot, and then starting to take off on some microtubule track. So here we know pretty much sure it's on a microtubule, and it's a motor that's capable of moving, so it's not in some other clump. So we can analyze this part. We can also analyze very rapidly. So we can put a lot of light in the system because they don't bleach. We can analyze with 5 millisecond time resolution. So this is a high resolution tracking, and we can analyze this in terms of mean square displacement now. So I'm switching to the sort of opposite, the Fourier way of describing it, not in terms of power spectral density, but mean square displacement. So we analyze the rapid motions of these stationary dots, and also the longer time motions of the stationary dots. We get this kind of behavior with the red and the green curve here. And that's quite interesting because it shows a shallower slope here. It shows this slope of 1 in the mean square displacement at intermediate times. And that corresponds exactly to this omega minus 2 in the power spectral density. Okay, now you might wonder, so mean square displacement of 1 means free diffusion in a viscous fluid, normally, right? But we know this is not a viscous medium because it's more or less elastic solid, the cell here. And I showed you before already that we get this omega minus 1 over omega squared behavior, which is exactly that same thing from these driving forces, from the Meissen driving forces. So we can show that this is the case here by turning off the Meissen. So here we have the control case. Here we have 10 micromolar of this drug blebbistatin. And here we've added 50 micromolar of blebbistatin. And you see that the amplitudes of the fluctuations go way down. And here you still have the slope of 1. But by the time you really switch off the motors good with this 50 micromolar concentration, the slope is way down. So the motion that we see here is clearly actively driven. It's not thermal in a viscous environment. And down here, we think we're looking so fast, because we can go down to milliseconds, that here we actually see thermal motions in the network. And up here, we see this turning over. And this is most probably the correlation time of the motors. Because I mentioned before, they typically have correlation times of seconds, 10 seconds or so. And here we are at 10 seconds. And here is where the curve turns over again. So I'll show you this in equations in a moment. I just want to show you one more control. We also did that on the moving one, like I showed you, by dissecting the tracks into, what time is it actually? Am I going? Yeah. Okay. Not so bad. By dissecting the axial from the off-axis motion, and so then analyzing the off-axis, actually both. So if you analyze the axial motion, you get a slope in the mean square displacement of close to 2, which is what people call ballistic motion, or it's this driven, motor-driven straight motion, more or less. So it's close to 2, it's a bit less than 2, because of course it's stopping and going, so it has some randomness to it. And so that motion persists even if we put blebbistatin in there. That's the blue curve. The black one is the control experiment. The blue curve is the blebbistatin experiment. And the kinesin-driven motion along the microtubules doesn't care. It just keeps going. But the off-axis motion that in the case without blebbistatin is strong here and has a slope 1 again, more or less disappears, and the slope of 1 is also not there anymore. And if you look at the scaling exponents that we get out of these power law regimes here, you see that in this regime, it's more or less 1. It's a bit more than 1, so we'll come back to that. It should actually be more than 1. And Fred was very happy about the fact that it was more than 1. This one is a bit less than 2, which it also should be. And when we add blebbistatin and turn the motors off, it goes back to something like 0.5 or so, which is sort of what you expect, a low slope, what you expect for passive fluctuations in a viscoelastic or more or less elastic network. So in order to make sense of that, let me at least quickly step through the model that, at this point, a relatively simple model that Fred mostly came up with. So just step back. So the shear elastic modulus in a polymer solution is something like scales, and at least in a frequency regime where you don't see a plateau, so at not too low frequencies, scales with an exponent of frequency that is typically between 0.5 for Rouse model to 0.75 for semi-flexible or so, but somewhere in the range between 0.5 and 0.8 for all systems that people have ever looked at. And that's polymer scaling, viscoelastic. Now, in cells, quite a few people have measured these scaling exponents, and at low enough frequencies, so in the video range, most people find not exactly plateau behavior, so it's not totally flat, but they find this weak slope of 0.1, weak power law of 0.1 to 0.2. Jeff Fredberg and Ben Fabry and people have worked on that, and there's all these soft gas rheology models and all these things, but wherever it comes from, but it's it's certainly not exactly flat, and it's a weak weak non-elasticity. It's almost elastic, almost perfectly elastic, the behavior of cells, but not quite. Now, if you calculate now, this is of course in Fourier space. Now, if you calculate the mean square displacement for a motion that's taking place in such a medium, it should scale with tau to the power of beta, the same beta as here. It's just looking at it in a different way. And from these arguments, of course, this beta must be less than one for any viscoelastic or elastic medium. Okay, so that's of course true for this is the thermal mean square displacement. That's true for cells and everything. Now, for active media, the mean square displacement, of course, can be larger, can scale with a power larger than one. It can be two in this ballistic case where it's just moving on a track, for example. But Tom Lubensky and Lau have calculated the case for small betas. It's only valid for small betas. In the case where you have random stresses in a network, and the result is that the mean square displacement should scale like tau to the power 1 plus 2 beta, where beta is this exponent here, this 0.1. It can't be this large, and it's not valid. But if it's a weak exponent, then this is what you should see for the active mean square displacement. Now, there's an interesting issue here. If the motion, of course, is active, then there's no problem with being super diffusive or having a slope that's larger than 1. That's what you see here. But in the usual case, this beta is quite small. And so if it's close to 0, then the scaling becomes tau to the 1. And that's more or less what we saw. And that, of course, looks deceptively like free diffusion in a viscous medium, although it's it's the total opposite. It's active stirring in an elastic medium. Okay, so active stirring in an elastic medium looks exactly the same, almost exactly the same as thermal motion in a viscous medium. There's no direct physical reason for that. It looks or why it has to be the same, but it just happens to be the same. And that has been deceiving many people. If you look at mean square displacements of one in the cell, then people say, okay, it must be viscous and must be thermal. And that's certainly not the case.
Okay. How small is small beta in general?
Well, I can show you. Actually, I should go back. I wanted to show you that. Sorry. So if we model this, these curves here, the black line is a model. I'll show you the complete formula on the next slide. But if you model it here in this regime here, we get a slope of about 1.4. Which means beta is 0.2. So, but it's this is not so sensitive to that. The data is not, it's quite accurate, but the beta is somewhere between 0.1 and 0.5 or so. Not 0.5, but maybe 1.1, 0.3 or so. So it's not so easy to nail down, but certainly less than 0.5.
What is the prefactor?
Well, the amplitude, of course, will depend on how many myosins are there and how they're coordinated and where you are in the cell and all that.
Depend on like particle size and viscosity of the medium?
Well, there's no particle size here, right? Because the it's a point particle that they're following, but it's sitting on a microtubule. So the particle size, the microtubule takes over the particle size if you want.
Yeah, but in the model that Andy and Tom have, is it there's no prefactor that scales with in the scaling where you get tau to the 1 plus 2 beta, is there a prefactor there that would allow you to distinguish experimentally between a viscous system and an active elastic system based on like particle size differences or differences in the viscosity of the medium?
Well, if you don't know the viscosity or the elasticity of the medium, you may know the particle size, but that's not enough, right? If you don't know the driving force and you don't know the response of the medium, you need more. You need more data. Okay, so the last thing I wanted to show you on this story was you can do it in a more general way by calculating the force fluctuations, divide them by the response of the medium, and then get the mean square displacement, or here the power spectral density. the force spectrum is we're taking it now from this Levine-McIntosh paper where this 1 over omega squared came in. But here there's also this correlation time of the motor. So if you go beyond that, then this or frequency below that, then it just becomes flat, right, the power spectrum. And that describes the turning over of the mean square displacement. And what we did in order to generate that curve that I showed you, the superimposed curve, is we used an active mean square displacement coming from these driving forces acting on the on the medium, which we assume has this weak power law of the beta that we put in as a parameter. So it turns out to be 0.2. And the thermal spectrum that is just a regular thermal spectrum. And that gives us, with another parameter, of course, for the amplitude, gives us this fitting curve that fits exceptionally well, I think, to the observed behavior. So it shows the leveling off, which is the thermal part. It shows the 1 plus 2 beta slope, giving beta of about 0.2. And it shows the leveling off here. And of course, the discrepancy here and here, but we'll talk about that separately. But in general, it seems to describe this behavior quite well. And the trick, of course, here is that we have 5 orders of magnitude in time in these video recordings, because these dyes are so stable and we can pump the hell out of them. So maybe in the last few minutes, because I'm going quite late here, I just want to show you briefly kind of different story, because we started discussing that yesterday. Actually, I should say this work, the nanotube work, is mostly done by Nikta Fakhri, the postdoc in my lab. And Alok Wessel has been setting up the microscope for the infrared microscopy. And the nanotubes come from Matteo Pasquali's lab at Rice. And Fred has been involved in the modeling. But another story that we kind of started discussing yesterday, very briefly, because nothing is finished. This is just totally new work and unfinished and everything. It's this question of how can you decide if a system is non-equilibrium or equilibrium if you don't have the luxury of having these two experiments, active and passive. And one way we are thinking is probably a good way to do it is to look for broken detailed balance in transitions in a system. So the idea is, if you have 3 different states in any old system, of course, detailed balance in equilibrium tells you that the transition rate of the system from one state to the other state has to be balanced with a reverse rate, so that there can't be any flux, any net flux in the system. So here, there can't be any circular flux, say, going around this way. If there was flux like that, then we know the system is out of equilibrium. And that's sort of the basic idea. If you now take the discrete states and make it a continuum state of some measurable, some quantity, some amplitude, or whatever you can measure, or velocity, and then you can look for broken detailed balance by looking for flux in phase space. And a simple model that we have set up, actually, it's a work. There's a collaboration with Chase Bruders at Princeton and Fred McIntosh in Amsterdam, and Chris Battle is the grad student who's doing that, and Nikta Fakhri is again holding the reins on this. So Chris has set up a simple model where we have just 2 beats coupled with a spring, and we can look at a case where both beats are driven thermally, there's random forces in the strictly one-dimensional, I should have drawn the arrows this way actually, in a one-dimensional simulation, or we can drive one of the beats with a sinusoidal driving force, and then this, again look at the 2 motions with the thermal force plus the driving force. Okay, very very simple situation. And so if we now plot the location actually of the 2 beats against each other in this sort of phase space set up by these 2 coordinates, and then we would expect, of course, some correlation between the 2. That's fine. But we would not expect any curl or any directed flux in that phase space. So what you see here is, for a finite simulation time, of course, some arrows that show the net movement of the system from one box to the next box. Now, this, of course, the system is running around in this phase space, and we let it run for a while, and then look at the net flux from one box to the next box. So the probability of being in the box is color-coded, and the arrows show the net flux from one box to the next box, to one boundary. And then we can look at the statistical significance, and white arrows here, as they should, are just random arrows. So the system is the one that's driven by 2 independent forces on the two beats. But now if you add a small driving force on one of the beats, say 5 kT in this case, you can see there's big flux in that phase space. So it's curling around in this direction. So of course, that's what you expect. And now the problem is, can you see that in real systems? And can you use that as a tool to distinguish if a system is out of equilibrium or not, if you just say have a video? So I show you a very obvious system as an example. So this is Chlamydomonas. It's a flagellum that we sheared off a Chlamydomonas alga. And it's in a medium that has ATP and everything, and has dynein motors, and so it's doing its beating, as if it was still swimming. Should repeat, actually. And so what Nikta did now is she did a mode analysis of these shape transformations, and looked at the first mode, second mode, third mode in a mode analysis. Actually, first, obviously, this thing is out of equilibrium. You can see that if you just track the backbone and plot that in a superposition, you see it's doing a very regular motion, of course. So we know it's out of equilibrium. It's a very clear case. But if you now take these mode amplitudes and plot them against each other in this phase space way, sorry, the numbers are small here, but they don't matter really. So if you plot the first against the second mode, or the first against the third mode, or first against the fourth mode, and just trace the temporal development of the system in these blue tracks. Of course, there's no directionality here, but what you see is that you get these very clear Lissajous-type figures. And so, and now, of course, I have to tell you that there's flux that's gone mostly in one direction and not in both directions. But that tells you, or is a clear measure of, well, a clear indication of non-equilibrium. Now, we don't know yet and how far we can get numbers out of this in terms of energy dissipation, for example, and so on. So it's just the first steps we do in this direction. But I wanted to show it to you because we were talking about that yesterday. So but now I want to come to an end. So in this case, we're looking for a way to quantify what activity is in the system, and we're looking for detailed balance, breaking of detailed balance. It's not clear how to get energies out of it, and it's also not so clear if you have a really marginal system how long we have to measure in order to get any reasonable criterion out of it. Of course, if you measure for 5 days, the system is stable, then you might get something out of it, but in a reasonable recording time, maybe if the system is too close to equilibrium, it may be hard. So we're trying it on a few real biological systems right now. But yeah, I just want to sort of throw it in and see if this creates some interesting discussions. So yeah, this like I said, this is done by Nikta also, and Chris Battle has been doing the simulations. And it's a collaboration with Chase and Fred. All right, thanks a lot. I guess I talked so fast that there wasn't too much chance for questions. So. Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Not this part, but the previous part where you were talking about in the active state, we did this MSD has a part of one. Can you think of this as a fluidized state? I know it's not a fluid state, but is there any similarity between like fluidized states?
No, it's certainly, I mean, if you look at a single point in the system, it's not going away. I mean, it's staying, I mean, it's confined, right? I mean, it's staying, it's going one for a while, but then it levels off again. So, of course, the part of the spectrum where it goes one, you could say, looks like a particle moving in a fluid, yes, Brownian particle moving in a fluid.
It's in granular materials, for example, something along those lines.
Well, it would be a funny fluid. Right? It's sort of a captured fluid on a small spatial scale. It looks like a fluid. You could say that. Yeah. I mean, actually, I didn't say that. The way we think it's important for biology might be that this, of course, is a way to enhance diffusion, if you want. And a lot of the non-specific transport in cells of ions and small molecules is done by diffusion. But we know, of course, it's a very dense medium, so it's kind of hard to get stuff in a large cell from one point to the other point. For neurons, where you have really long distances, of course, you need directed transport. But directed transport has to be specific. You need a machine, you need attachment, you need an address. You need the whole machinery to put the right part on the right motor and then get that motor to the other end and release it again. So it's a very costly process to transport things long distance. But this non-equilibrium kind of general mechanism is sort of like a stirring. That's why we call it stirring. So it's just sort of stirring up the cell, and it's enhancing a small solute transport. It should. Now, in how far that's important and relevant needs to be seen, but it's certainly an intermediate way of transporting materials and cells. It's not specific and directed, and it's not just thermal. It's in between. And the motions are quite vigorous, so it should make quite a difference. Yeah?
In the first experiment, when you had multiple leads
Can you track correlations between the beads?
Yeah, that's what, and I didn't mention it, but the other way to do this rheology is by looking at what's called two-particle microrheology. So you just look at the correlations. In the cell example, actually, what I showed were the correlations. Because you look at, you know, you just do the cross-correlation, the Fourier transform of the cross-correlation function of the two particles. And that gives you the dip and all that stuff. So, but you can also do it in a 3D continuum medium, and it has a couple of advantages. You know, looking at the sort of only the long-range elastic forces gets you away from the local stuff. So if there's a local depletion layer, for example, around the beads, you don't see that in two particle.
So my understanding is single particle, and as soon as you put something in, it changes the structure around, and so you end up not investigating the entire medium, yep, but actually something very strongly defensive.
Yeah.
So using two is always better than one. So you're looking through the medium.
It gets you away from that problem.
It is, but always, you know, so it's more complicated.
But you catch a bunch of new problems, so that's.
Yeah. But you're ideally looking at, you know, something which is going through a medium which is largely disturbed.
Yeah, I mean, you see more or less the bulk behavior.
Yeah.
The disadvantage is that the noise is very high, so the signal goes down. Like, you know, the displacement field falls off like 1 of R. So if you're 10 diameters away, say, then the signal is getting very weak. And so it takes a lot of averaging to get a good curve out of it. And the other sort of more subtle story is that, of course, sometimes it's nice to see what's happening around the bead. If you have a vesicle in a cell, that's, of course, acting like a bead, and then you would like to know what the vesicle is doing. And we have another story that's just being published where we actually analyze the local bending motions of the actin filaments around the particle, and they turn out to be quite important. So if you have a small particle, then the motions become size independent. They become dominated by the bending deformation of the filaments in the semi-flexible network. So it's complicated.
I have another nice question.
No, for Tom was first. Sorry.
Explain it to me or something. With the vesicle motion, we're doing quite a lot of work about that recently, and it looked like your analysis was very focused on the second moment that's recently in XD. What we seem to be thinking, other people like Ralph Metz, for instance, if you have a few different statistical measures, you can see a lot more information in your track data than just the MSD. For example, you can get directionality fairly easily and getting the cosine of the segments if you sort of track the segment. And if you do that, I think it's a lot more rigorous sort of challenge for your models than just the MSD.
That's a good point. Yeah, I mean, this is for our first sort of pass on this. I mean, we have looked at the in vitro, we have done this Van Hove correlation function story earlier, and then this is a way to look at the
passage probability, but you get a whole stack of them and then really challenge your model with all of them at the same time.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. I mean, this is something we haven't looked at with these data I looked into, but.
They got some nice measures. There's even an MSD version where they average over different times to actually see ergodicity as well, which Ralph Metz has been doing in live cells quite a lot. Mm-hmm. That looks quite reasonable, and you can actually see if your MSD is ergodic or not by the way it holds at the time.
I have to think about that, but maybe in some interesting way it's also related to.
So we're trying to look at continuous time random warps or fractal Brownian motion. So there's you're doing a viscoelastic approach, which I guess Fredenkai's line, but you could also look at a statistical approach. And they are actually able, if you get these different, rather than just using MSD, using a few different ones, you can actually tell the difference between these things. Is there ergodicity in the motion or is there not, for example, which is. I think it'd be quite powerful.
I have to think about it. I'm not so sure about the connection between detailed balance and this higher moments of the thing, because you lose the time information in a way, right?
There's a whole load of different, subtly different things. That one of them is just with the MSD looking at different time averages over it, and then they claim you can tell if it's a continuous time random or non-ergodic. And then there's other ones which are ergodic, which I think is fractal Brownian motion.
I think something that is looking like, say, a Gaussian distribution or so of probability doesn't have to be Brownian, right? So that's not a criterion that tells you it's Brownian.
Sure.
It's not enough.
Sure.
But on the other hand, the non-Gaussian shape of the distribution can tell you something about the characteristics of the driving force, for example.
So you've shown was average is all along time.
It averages over a long time and on the order of 20 to 30 particles. The smooth curves. These guys here. Yeah, or these, for example. These were averages over about. Oh, which ones?
No, I'm asking about detailed pairs.
Which ones?
About violation of detailed pairs.
Oh, okay. Typically the time is something like a few minutes of recording, maybe 3-4 minutes or so, and then we typically average again on the order of 10 to 20 beats or so. The high frequency part is usually not a problem because you have of course if you have a long enough recording you get lots of data for the higher frequencies, but the low frequency part gets very noisy if you just look at a single run of 2 minutes. So you have to average quite a few to get it smooth. This is the beginning, yeah, the stuff in vitro you meant, right? It's going to take too long here. These curves, for example, right? So this is also done with a number of beats on cells and recording times of a few minutes and the in vitro experiments here. Yeah, and all of this noisiness here persists even if you have, say, 20 or 30 recordings average. So it's very hard to get at 0.1 hertz to get smooth data. So yeah, that's you have to average.
I will come back to my question then.
I'm pushed to the side.
In the third section of your talk, the cilia there has a natural curvature, and then it beats, and then the symmetry breaking, it's the scallop theorem, which means.
Oh, why it can move? Yeah. If you have higher modes of motion, scallop is not a problem.
So the cilia which has that, so in that sense, you would expect it to have some transport. And because we're not attached to now bigger body.
But I showed this Rosetta, yeah.
It's going to spin. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, there's no puzzle, I think, in that, right? If you have a pure scallop, of course, that's a famous problem, but that's a one hinge thing.
Right.
And here you have a whole filament with lots of motors in it, so it can do anything it wants, right?
Right.
It has enough degrees of freedom to propel itself.
Right, so you have a cilia now with a natural curvature, was it?
I don't think you need the natural curvature.
But you need it to beat in a slightly asymmetric way and it will propel itself.
Yeah, it has to beat in a somewhat coordinated way so that it makes the forward motion in one way and the backward motion in some slightly different way. It's sort of like something
so
like that.
How did you connect it with this, with the model you started on with two beads and a square?
Well, in that case, we didn't look at such details at all. We just looked at the...
Section, you start off with a simulation. Two beads and a spring, and you said something about one bead being vibrated with a frequency,
mm-hmm.
and then it moves.
So,
I didn't quite catch. So.
Okay, let me just get back to the.
Your talk is 3 hours long, and you condensed into one.
I wanted to show you all the good stuff. So the idea here is you'd have these two coordinates and. Driving this one, of course, talks to this one, and it talks.
Supposing I have so this is embedded in this.
Viscous damping. Nothing special, in one dimensional. So pushing on this guy will make this guy move a little later.
Right.
That's basically what it is, right? So there's a little delay in the. Until the force reaches, or the displacement actually comes up. The force comes up right away, but the displacement takes a little while to.
General, there will be a phase lag. Right?
There's a phase lag, and that phase lag, this is always leading, and this is always lagging.
Okay.
And that's the whole flux in phase space. That makes it go around in a circle if you plot it in here, right? So I guess we could follow this in detail. So x1, say x1 is going minus. And X2 is not doing anything yet, and then X2 comes up, goes whatever the direction, I think it should be defined in the same way. So it also goes minus a little later, and then X1 goes already back, and X2 doesn't react yet, but then out here, X2 reacts and comes back. And so it's just, it's just doing this sort of slightly delayed kind of thing.
And so you're using that as a basic model of the cilia beating the
Just to show that in this obviously driven, or in a case where you have both thermal driving and active driving, to look for this curl in phase space and look how far down you can see it. I mean, how little driving force is enough to give you a good curl here, and what's a good measure for the curl. I mean, we're still kind of struggling because the curl, of course, doesn't have to have a particular scale. So you need to be aware of the box size, for example. If you make the boxes too large, then you don't get any more curl, and so on. So it's a bit of groping in the dark still. But it's just the simplest model we could think of having a system with 2 degrees of freedom or 2 variables that we can follow, where we can, you know, either thermally drive the two and we should not get any flux in phase space, or drive one of them and then we should get flux.
In that case, if I just switch it and ask if I put 2 different views in size with a spring and it's thermally agitated.
Well, then the amplitudes are going to change, but it's not going to change the effect that you get curl. So I mean, of course, the system and the viscosity we chose and the spring stiffness we chose and all that defines the amplitudes here and all that stuff, and the timing and you know. But we haven't really done anything special to that. We haven't tried to, you know, mimic this, for example. I mean, here, of course, there's all sorts of interesting stuff going on which we ignore. We just look at the modes, the first mode, second mode, third mode, and look if there's any flux in that phase space. So all the details of if it's moving or where it's moving, and you know, we just kicked out. I mean, the center of mass motion we didn't take into account, for example. Just the one could, yeah, one could. Would be another variable. Should also work.
So the persistence length would be, if you went one step above this, would be another variable.
Persistence length.
So there would be some bending elasticity, not just spring-type elasticity for the spring.
Oh, and this is if you want a two-dimensional thing, the other one was one-dimensional. So yeah, of course, the modes have to do with the bending elasticity of the whole flagellum, and the driving is done in a totally different way, and it's just a totally different thing. But
right now you have something which is like a freely jointed thing. You have 2 beads and you have a spring, right? There is no persistence, right? So that's what I'm saying. In a flagella kind of thing, you would have, it's more like a filament rather than just a spring.
Yeah, sure, but the idea was not to model the.
I know,
the
it's
just a toy model.
Nice model.
Simplest toy model, basically.
Talking of that, can we go back to the thing where you were using the microtubule as a probe?
The nanotubes.
The nanotubes as a probe.
Yeah, so that is a different talk. I don't think you want to all stay here. I was just showing one slide.
Yeah,
but the slide before that?
No, the before.
This one.
I wanted to understand something a little bit more on that.
Okay.
So one is. So in the reason 1.1 rheology, we don't like that so much is because it will probe the local environment.
It will deform, I mean, it will deplete.
Right. So if you have something like a nanotube, isn't there always the danger that it can get stuck in a crowded area and not be able to move out of that?
Well, if it gets stuck, you see it. And so if it's... And the problem is, if it's not stuck, you know it's not stuck, but on the other hand, you get reptation. And that's kind of hard to separate out from the network fluctuations.
That's another thing. The next thing I was going to ask is, how do you separate out the network correlations and the fact that it's the same?
That's a bit of a pain in the butt. So we have a few examples where it was stuck, and then of course you can compare the stuck ones with the non-stuck ones, or you can compare many stuck ones if they're all the same, or so we can do all these usual experimental tricks. So far, it looks like the reptations are dominating the mode relaxation dynamics for the ones that are not stuck. So we don't get away from these large apparent fluctuations.
Right.
But if it's in a tube and the tube is totally rigid and it migrates somewhere else and it looks like the thing has relaxed,
right,
or has moved, but the network hasn't moved at all. It's just that the filament has reptated. So we thought about only taking the center part and sort of forgetting about the fluctuations and all that, but even the network is moving itself. So if you have a stationary segment that you take out of your video, it's not reflecting a stationary blob of your network because the network is fluctuating. Right? So it's not so easy.
It's difficult to both, I guess, experimentally and even theoretically separate out the network effect.
Yeah, Fred was sort of trying, and then we were hoping that maybe the higher modes would be affected more than the lower modes, that you could just, you know, differentiate by modes. It's not so clear. I mean, one way to go around it is to use very long nanotubes. So if you make them 30 microns long, then the reptation effect is becoming marginal. and they replicate pretty slowly. So that is one way. And the other one would be to pointwise stick them down, but in a very controlled way, that you only stick one point down and don't make a clump. That should eventually also work. We tried a little bit, but
you change the surface chemistry and actually change the confinement potential, because that might be quite fun as well. Because there's Rossum models with David Moles and people who have confinement potential. Then we'll get the dynamics of that sort of thing.
By making it stick to something, you mean, or?
Well, just modifying. I mean, it's unusual. People have done a lot of things with fluorescent actins, and then it's all the same potential for everything. But now you've got a foreign object you put in there, so you could play around with that potential and see what's going on.
I mean, there's supposedly some interaction, of course. It's negatively charged, but it's screened out anyway, so it's high salt concentration.
But you make them soluble by changing, functionalizing them somehow. You can play around with that.
With DNA, so it's negatively charged due to the DNA, and that should keep them moving, or keep them from sticking.
I mean, they're negatively charged, acting as negatively charged, so that stabilizes them. But you can play around with the charge a little bit to see.
Yeah, one. I mean, yes, I haven't thought so much about it. I mean, of course, if you want to sort of see the fluctuations very locally, you have to look at the highest modes, because the long modes basically reflect the motion of the gel on that same scale. And if you look at the first mode of a 10 micron nanotube, it reflects the motion of a blob of 10 microns of the gel. So then the local confinement potential is not going to be relevant at all. So you have to look at a 100 nanometer mode in order to see the local confinement. And that's sort of not what we're aiming for. We were aiming for the other end. We were aiming for the long modes.
Right. It's not changing the entanglement length, though, if you play around with potential.
Maybe you would see that in the reptation dynamics. But I mean, if you just look at the lateral fluctuations of the filament, I think you really have to get down to the very high short wavelengths or higher modes in order to see the local dynamics in the tube, if you want. So this picture of rattling in the tube, I think it's very misleading, because I mean, there's papers by Josef, or so KS has done these things of actin filament and sort of showing a superposition of frames and saying, oh, that's the tube size. Of course, that's not right, because the whole network is fluctuating. And if you look at a piece of filament that's, say, 5 microns long, you see the fluctuations of the network on that scale. You don't see the thing rattling in the tube.
Right.
Because by the time, I mean, it very quickly reaches the end of the tube anyway, when it's on a totally different time scale. And then if you look at the time scales where you see the motion of the 5 micron mode, then it's seeing the gel motion. It's not seeing the tube. So, so if you want to see something very small, I think you need to go to small tubes. It doesn't give you any advantage to go to these long probes.
Mentioned something about the modes here being null signs and cosines. Is this a nonlinear effect?
No, it's the end effect. It's I'm getting into the other talk.
How many modes can you see actually?
On the nanotubes, depending on the length, but like 6, 7, 8 modes.
And you can calculate relaxation times for these 6 or 7?
Yeah, well, I should pull this other talk, and we should talk about it, or whoever is interested, we can talk about it separately. The problem with the relaxation times, we naively did it. And first we did it with the cosine modes, and then the modes were mixed. So we didn't get the 1 over Q squared behavior that we were expecting. But that was known before. So Fred Giddes in this Mikey Tubel paper talked about it. And actually the theory goes back to Aragon Pecora in the 70s that looked at DNA fluctuations. They have the proper normal modes, the proper dynamic normal modes, and they're these cosine, hyperbolic cosines and sines and so forth, and they're well known. And if you analyze with those modes, it at least looks better in terms of mode coupling, so that they look more decoupled. But the problem is that you still mainly, in the experiments, you mainly see the reptation, and you don't see the network fluctuations. And of course, from the network, we can predict how the, sort of a lengthy story. So if you look at the amplitude-amplitude correlation function of the modes, and do that for all the modes, you would expect a slope going up like this t or tau to the beta, exactly the same scaling exponent that we're talking about. So say 3/4 or so. So it should be going up like t to the 3/4, and then it should level off when it when it either reaches a plateau or when the network stiffness becomes negligible compared to the bending stiffness of the filament. So in principle, it could go to two plateaus. So it could go to one plateau of the network, and then it could reptate out of the position and go to another plateau. And if you look at a different mode, they should cross over. So let's say this is mode one. So mode two should go like this and then go over here and stay below the mode, because the bending energy of the higher mode is higher, so there's less amplitude in the higher mode, but the relaxation time is faster, so there's a faster relaxation of the higher mode. So we were expecting sort of to see that, but the problem is that we don't really get the proper relaxation of a stationary tube yet, or the few examples that we have, we don't see much relaxation. So we see all these things, but sometimes the one is down, two is up, three is here, but sometimes one is up here, and two is down here, and three is down here. So the rotation really messes it all up. And so I think experimentally we have to nail them down and make them very long and suppress the dominating effect of reptation. But qualitatively, that's what you expect. I mean, you expect at high time resolution or at short times to see the network. And then whatever the network does, if it has a plateau, you should see a plateau. And then eventually, when it reptates out of the network, of course, if it doesn't reptate, then this should be flat. If it can't get away, if it's bent and stuck like that, then it should stay forever like that. If it's a elastic, not viscous network anymore. But if it can reptate out, it should eventually go to the equilibrium position of the straight filament. So yeah, it's work in progress. So it is interesting, but not so easy. But the nice thing is that we can get into small spaces. So Nikta has gotten them into the nucleus also, into cells. And of course, then you can look at, without disturbing anything, without putting beads or anything in there, you can look at dynamics in the nucleus, or you can look at non-equilibrium in the nucleus and all that. So it's interesting, but the evaluation or the modeling is tricky.
Is this essentially three-dimensional?
Well, we also tried a bit three-dimensional. So it's of course we see we have one focal plane, but you can of course analyze when you fit the curves across the across the cross section, and you fit it with a Gaussian, and the width of the Gaussian tells you the z, and so in principle you can fit to a certain extent, you can also get the z direction, but the data is fairly noisy. If you look at this stuff here. Or here, so it's really hard to, with high time resolution, to get a good Z information out of it.
Chosen to show the movies.
This is one where it stays more or less in the plane. Yeah, of course, if it's out of plane to begin with, then you're in trouble. But you can always look for one that happens to be for a while in one plane. But,
don't carbon nanotubes actually kill the cells to get the aspect ratio
wrong? No.
Asbestosis or something
else. No, actually, people have done this toxicity stuff for a while. They're fed rabbits. They've stuffed like rats and rabbits with nanotubes, and nothing happens.
One of my colleagues put it apparently the opposite.
Is that right?
They actually were killing cells, and there was a critical aspect ratio. Maybe there's two different groups of these.
Maybe multi-walled.
Are
you sure it's single-walled? Multi-walled is a different story.
Right. Okay. So multi-walled do kill cells.
Multi-walled are stiff, so the whole asbestos story comes from the rigidity.
Okay.
And these guys are like actin, so the cell is used to actin, so the cell doesn't care about something bendable and flexible. And they don't seem to go very easily through membranes, because we can inject them into C. We do other experiments with C. elegans, mm-hmm. So we can inject them into C. elegans. They live happily for many generations. They get passed on into the progeny and everything, but we get them into nerve cells and they stay in the neurons more or less. But the worms don't care.
The cells can't metabolize them, so they're there forever if they get in.
They stick around, yeah. I mean, somehow they get into the progeny, into the eggs, which is not clear how yet. But
that sounds quite boring.
But if they get too close to the spindle during cell division, I can imagine they would, mess that up.
I mean, they're just like actin, right? It's 1 nanometer. It's almost nothing.
1 nanometer.
And they're very, very thin and very flexible.
But how long are these?
Well, these guys are 20 microns or so, but you can make them, it's a distribution of length, but usually you can separate them out if you want, and which takes a bit more material. So we have worked with a mixture. And the other thing, the sort of little secret in this business is in this experiment, you only see the ones that happen to be fluorescent at the right wavelength. There's many more that are metallic. Or fluorescing at a different wavelength. So this is a in a way, first approximation, but you can sort them out by color, and you can sort them out by length and everything you want.
Do they keep their DNA code?
Yeah, they're really stable. They're really stable. I mean, we were worried about DNAs in cells.
Yeah.
And Strano's group at MIT has done some stuff, and they have put them in cells for 2 weeks, and they're just happily fluorescing. Because if they lose the code, they aggregate and stop fluorescing. So as long as they're nice fluorescent and wiggle around, you know they have the code. And the DNA somehow can't get to the DNA when it's wrapped around. It's very tightly wrapped. It's a single strand, so the bases are sitting on the surface of the nanotube, and the backbone is outside. And the enzymes can't deal with that configuration. It's just not susceptible to DNAs. So that's lucky. I mean, there's other ways to make them soluble, but DNA is nice because you can modify it. And it's nicely charged, doesn't bind to anything in the cell normally.
Yeah.
What sort of camera are you actually using to get the
infrared? We have two. We have an EMCCD for the. I showed you in the beginning. They come in different flavors, right? So there's very sharp lines, and the one sample we have has a lot of the 6 fibers they called, and they fluoresce at 980, and that's just barely still visible on the silicon detector. And then we have an InGaAs. We have an InGaAs camera which gives us higher intensity. So it's not quite as the quantum efficiency is a bit lower and. But we see all the guys.
They make them commercially, and they're reasonably good quality
infrared detectors. Yeah, we bought one of them. And there's this issue of in Europe you can't buy the American ones because of weapon whatever. And, yeah, so we had to buy the German camera, which maybe is not quite as good as the photometrics. So I don't know, but. Yeah, I mean it's no problem, and the imaging is easy, and filters and stuff you can get. It's all easy. Oh, we did already. Yeah. Yeah, I think. Thanks. I don't want to keep you from dinner.